This is Nightlife with Suzanne Hill.
Well, do you know anyone who is a fan of gentle parenting? You might have heard them saying things to their kids like, I can see you're having some big feelings right now. Hands aren't for hitting. Was that a good choice? Always in that calm, soothing voice, even if the kiddie's in the middle of a full-blown meltdown. It might be a bit different to what you might have experienced. I remember hearing the lines, I mean, my grandmother was always saying, children should be seen and not heard. I'll give you to the count of three. How about stop crying or I'll give you something to cry about. Well, we might not understand the parenting trends of the current generation, but we also might not get why previous generations parented the way they did. What we can agree on is that when it comes to parenting, almost everyone has their own advice, and it's been that way throughout history. So if the way children are brought into the world hasn't changed, how come the way they're brought up in it has been through countless changes, shifts, and transformations? So how was the parenting that you were brought up with different to the parenting you delivered? What influenced the way you parented? When you look at the way your kids or grandkids are parenting, what do you make of it? I want to hear your thoughts and your experiences. 1-300-800-222. Now, Dr. Spock, how many of you were around in the days of Dr. Spock? Dr. Spock's advice to parents was, don't be overawed by what the experts say. But in the spirit of tonight's discussion, we're going to ignore that and welcome two experts to Nightlife to explore the history of parenting with us. Alistair Thompson is an Emeritus Professor of History at Monash University and co-author of Fathering an Australian History. Hello, Alistair. Welcome to Nightlife.
Hi, Suzanne, and thanks for having us on the last show of the year.
You're very welcome. We've also got with us Katie Holmes. Katie's a professor of history at La Trobe University. Hello, Katie. Welcome to you.
Hi, Suzanne. Nice to be with you.
Alistair, I'm going to start with you. When we think about how we define parenting, is it more, you know, is it about more than how we raise and care for kids? Is there a broader societal context to it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, parenting is obviously about raising and caring for kids. It's always been that. But it's also about providing for kids, putting a roof over their head, food on the table, basic support and education and so on. And in Australia, certainly over the last century, that role has tended, the division between the caring role and the providing role has tended to be divided along gender lines, certainly since the basic wage was introduced in the early 20th century, which was set such that the working man's wage would be sufficient to keep his wife and three kids in reasonably frugal comfort, which basically meant that working men, whether or not they had kids, got paid more than working women. And so it put a lot of pressure on families. It made it much more likely that the father would be the breadwinner and the mother would be the carer. Now, there were plenty of women who also worked, but it was structured in that men tended to be the providers. So that's a really significant, and in Australia, we institutionalize that in ways that other Western countries don't necessarily do. So it's really set hard in Australia in the early 20th century.
Right. So
it doesn't mean, it doesn't mean that providers don't care for their kids. And there's a lovely notion of affective significance that actually working really hard to provide your kids can be an act of deep love and affection. But actually, it's probably not all you want to be as a parent. But for a lot of the last century, a lot of blokes have been structured into that role. And equally, women have been structured into raising kids much more than men.
Oh, interesting, Alistair, because I think when we perhaps look back at the father figures, you know, that might be institutionalized on TV. I mean, I watched the movie Dead Poets Society a few weeks ago, which has that classic authoritarian, stern father who was all about providing all the opportunities for his son. I think from our perspective, we might look back and judge perhaps those fathers in a way that wasn't happening at the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very powerful model that the kid ends up suiciding because the father is just so strict and demanding. I mean, I think, certainly through the 20th century, Australian dads, they've been providers. They've also often had a significant disciplinary role, particularly for teenage boys. There's an expectation that boys need fathers, teenage boys in particular need fathers to manage them, to control them, to direct them and so on. So you can see where that type of disciplinary authoritarian father figure comes from.
We're talking about the history of parenting here on Nightlife tonight, and I want to hear your takes. Have you experienced various different types? Perhaps you were brought up one way and now you're parenting your children a different way. Maybe your own kids are parenting your grandkids a different way. What have you noticed? 1-300-800-222. Katie Holmes, what have been the biggest shifts in parenting from how the older generation might have done it?
So I think there's a number of things that influence the ways in which parenting has been understood and its significance understood. And some of those have been about different kind of theories of parenting and child development. And others have been what we might understand more broadly as sort of changing historical circumstances. So one of the really significant things about parenting is the size of families. So when you have reliable birth control and a decrease in family size, that has significant implications on how we parent, because you can have a kind of more intensive model of parenting when you haven't got, you know, 5, 6, 7 plus kids to look after, and a situation where kids will be responsible for parenting each other. So that's one thing that really shapes the family. Another thing is women's liberation movement of the 70s and 80s, which brings in, you know, huge critiques of the family and opens up the opportunities and the conditions for middle-class women's entry into the paid workforce in significant numbers. Now, working-class women had been there for a long time already, but so with women's entry into the paid workforce, you have significant changes in family dynamics. Women are moving out of the domestic sphere, and they are also challenging the idea that they should be the primary carer, and they're calling on men to play more active roles as fathers. They also become major contributors to the family income, and that also causes, you know, has long-term implications, such as an expectation that if you're going to buy a house now, you need to, you know, you need to be a two-income family. You know, that relates back to the fact that women are now in the workforce. So you've also got significant changes in the understanding of children's development, and we can talk about this in a bit more detail, but you've already mentioned Spock. You know, Truby King was the early 20th century New Zealand doctor who promoted the very authoritarian understanding of parenting that Spock was kind of a reaction to. And the other thing that's changed, you know, in the context of parenting is the world has changed significantly. There's greater affluence. There's huge proliferation of advice about what makes a good parent, and now endless access to, you know, ideas about what that looks like and what should be said, the kind of conversations that you have with your child. There's different ideas about what one keeps secret about, what you're able to talk about with your kids, what you're able to talk about in the context of family. So, you know, back in the sort of 60s, 70s even, there were a lot of, and earlier, reproductive secrets. You mentioned that the writer who's going to be on in the second hour talking about, you know, forced adoption. Forced adoption comes out of a lot of secrecy around reproduction and pregnancy. So that was something that couldn't be talked about. But domestic violence is still something that we talk a lot more about now, but it's still something that a lot of women feel a lot of shame around. We've got postnatal depression, mental health. Those things are opening up, but there's still secrets around those within the context of the family. And I think the other key change is an understanding that the child-parent relationship is actually a relationship. It's not just about training a child and disciplining a new child. So there are a huge array of shifts, I think, that we can look at.
Yeah, I mean, Katie, one of the first things you said caught my attention. You know, when families were having 9 kids and effectively the older children would be raising the younger children, these days we focus so much, don't we, on kids having quality time with their parents, kids deserving all of this attention. But that must be a relatively new idea that in order for a child to thrive, they have to have that one-on-one and special time with their parent.
Absolutely, very new idea. Yes, I mean, my father was the youngest of 7. You know, that was not at all unusual. It was my mother was one of two, and that was unusual at the when she was born in 29. And actually, the Depression period, this families were smaller because simply they couldn't afford to have too many children. But in the 50s, the average family size is four, and then it decreases and has been decreasing ever since. So you've just, with smaller families, you've got more time, and so you get ideas around intensive mothering, intensive parenting that were just simply not practical in earlier periods when family sizes were so large. So those ideas about what makes a good parent are really shaped by things as basic as how many kids you have in a family.
You're on Nightlife on ABC Radio. My guests are Alistair Thompson. He's the author of Fathering, an Australian History. And Katie Holmes is with me too, Professor of History and Director of La Trobe University's Centre for the Study of the Inland. Alistair, I'll go back to you. And I mean, Katie's been touching on some of the exterior forces that shape families and also shape how parenting is done. I mean, tell us about, for example, how was baby boom parenting affected by the experience of those parents having lived through the Depression and then World War II?
Yeah, no, the external factors that affect family. I mean, every family makes its own decisions about how they're going to parent, but always shaped by the prevailing cultural expectations at the time, and always shaped by external factors, which might be the basic wage that I talked about before, or the fact that the tax and welfare system after World War II favoured single-income fathers with a male breadwinner and a mother at home. And more recently, and we'll talk later about how working structures, parental leave and so on, affect the decisions that people make. But also big historical events like the economic depression in the 1930s and then World War II profoundly affected families. If the basic wage created in the early 20th century assumed that fathers would be able to manage, provide for a family without a second income, then the depression knocked that on the head because so many fathers were unemployed and so many women had to work and so many families struggled. And what's really interesting, when you listen to interviews with people who grew up in the 1930s and then became parents in the 1940s, 50s and 60s, they very much wanted to, they were shaped by the real difficulties that their parents had. And so the fathers of the 1950s really wanted to be successful providers because their own dads had struggled. And often many women also wanted to have enough time to actually be able to care for their kids. So the Depression had that effect. World War II is also really interesting because obviously many men go away to war. Quite a number of women go into work. And we'll come on and talk about it. There are shifting ideas about the role of parents. But one of the things that happens during World War II is a real fear that juvenile delinquency is going to be caused by either absent fathers or working mothers. And there's a lot of concern at the time, which leads to the development of theories about the role of parents. And one of the really interesting theories that develops during World War II, and it's actually initiated by a psychologist called Bowlby in the United Kingdom, and he studied kids who'd been evacuated during World War II away from their parents to get away from the Blitz, and came up with this theory of maternal deprivation theory, that actually if kids lost, and he thought it was about women, if kids lost that real attachment and care by a mother, then they were going to be psychologically damaged. And that becomes a very powerful theory that develops into a notion of attachment theory that's heavily gendered and sort of is linked to, after World War II, not only is there an expectation that men will come back from war and go into work and they'll get married and that their wives will raise kids, but also there's this new set of psychological ideas about maternal deprivation and about attachment that really signal that women really need to put a lot of time and effort into caring, really taking that caring role, nurturing role very seriously. And it sort of intensifies that gender divide between fathers and mothers.
And I mean, women who are perceived as being cold mothers have copped a lot over the years. I mean, in the early days of trying to understand the causes of autism, I've sort of read many times that it was, they had a cold mother and that was what was going on.
Yeah, you look at the history of psychology and you just think, how the hell did they think that in those times and that those sort of ideas? But they're heavily influenced by ideas about gender roles, by some pretty dodgy notions about child development. The assumption that only a mother can successfully love and nurture a child. I mean, we now know that actually kids need love and nurture, but it doesn't only have to be one parent and it doesn't necessarily have to be a mother. And interestingly, actually, you talked right at the start about how we define parenting. In Australia, we have a real alternative to the sort of nuclear family model of the provider dad and the caring mother in First Nations families, because First Nations Australians, long before European settlement, had a culture of extended family care. So, yes, you had a mother and a father biologically, but uncles and aunts and grandparents played significant roles. And indeed, one of the reasons why First Nation families survived the sort of full frontal attack on them across the last couple hundred years is because when fathers are forced away or when kids are taken away from parents, other people, uncles and aunts, step in, and the extended family is really significant. And that's a sort of an inspiration for all of us that actually a larger extended family, as if you like, a family village supporting kids, not just the single mother struggling at home by themselves.
You're on Nightlife on ABC Radio. A few of your SMSs coming in. This one from Tom. My father was born in 1902 and fathered six kids. He didn't see any of the births but was pacing the corridors, hiding a cigarette behind his hand. Probably didn't even need to hide it in those days, Tom. My children, now all adults, had their dad right there at the birth. I did prenatal training. Later on with their primary school, I was the parent, teachers group chairperson. I spent a lot of time at the school, you know, riding bikes with them and the neighbours. Best times of my life, says Tom. Tony says, I'm a first generation child of Chinese parents in the 60s. I was left free range to look after myself. While there was some discipline, they implicitly trusted me. I now have two adult daughters and my wife and I adopted a similar approach to bringing them up. As a result, both of them have grown up to be fine adults. We never had any teenage angst or rebellion. Philip says, today's kids are mollycoddled by their parents, and that's how we spoil them, and we even idolise them. What are your thoughts? What are your experiences? What are your observations? I wonder if you've lived through, perhaps you were brought up in one way and you've brought your own kids up in a different way. We're talking about how parenting has changed in Australia. I guess we're sort of going back to really World War II as a bit of a starting point, but I'd love to have your input on Nightlife tonight, 1300 800 222. Katie, can you take us through the complexities of how parenting knowledge is passed down between generations of mothers?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. And I think it is complex and it is multi-layered, really, you know, because some of that is an instinctive thing that you kind of, you know, as my mother would say, you kind of imbibe it with your mother's milk. You take on that understanding of how you parent through the way that you've been parented. And unless you consciously make decisions about, you know, deciding that you want to parent differently, a lot of the ways in which I think we parent are really subconsciously and unconsciously influenced by our own experiences of being a parent. Now, mothers really often like to give advice based on their mothering experience to their, you know, their daughters in particular as they become mothers, because they generally feel that they've got a contribution to make. You know, they've been there before and they've got a lot of experience here. That advice is not always so well received. I think a lot of my friends who are moving into the grandparent role find themselves holding their tongue a lot because they sense that their perceptions are not particularly valued. And I think that we've also got a situation where a mother can set up expectations for her daughters about what it means to be a good mother. And those expectations can often be just, again, imbibed, leading to, you know, guilt, leading to a sense that of failure, of not being good enough. There's some of the more negative things. Of course, you know, there can be wonderful understandings that are also passed on. But I think that, you know, we've talked already about the ways in which parenting ideas change, and that's another thing that influences the way in which parenting knowledge gets passed on, is that you have different influences shaping the understanding of what, you know, what a good mother now is. And that can be where some of the conflict can arise between generations. Sometimes grandmothers can be, you know, a really significant influence, where a mother might not be able to be so significant. My mother used to talk about the way her grandmother, whom she adored, when, you know, four-hourly feeding was the popular, you know, rule of the day, and my brother did not seem to appreciate formula feeding as a baby. And, you know, but that was what the infant welfare sister told my mother was the way to go. And my grandmother said to her, he's hungry, for goodness sake, just feed him. And that relieved my mother of that burden of the kind of the expert telling her what to do when someone that she really trusted said, who had a lot of experience as a mother and a parent, said, he's hungry, feed him. So there's all sorts of ways and generational ways in which I think parenting gets handed down. And it's also very culturally dependent as well. And it can be aunts, it can be other, you know, senior or elder women within the family who can be an influence when sometimes the mother might not be the most welcome voice in your head.
I'll go back to Alistair now. Alistair Thompson is the author of Fathering and Australian History. So, Alistair, if we go back to the baby boomers, and I know many of our listeners are baby boomers who were brought up by the parents who'd come out of the Depression and World War II, what parenting style was most dominant then?
Look, it's interesting. You've still got that lingering authoritarian, stern, disciplinarian dad. But to be honest, by the 1950s, that's less prevalent. It's certainly less prevalent in the cultural advice. There's, you know, as there often is, this notion of new fathers that should be more caring, more affectionate, more involved. Interesting, Katie talked about generational transmission. There's often this notion throughout the 20th century into the 21st century of the next generation of fathers are going to be new fathers, but they don't always change that much, and we'll come back to that. But I guess in the 50s and 60s, there are things that are changing, that are shifting away from that more authoritarian and disciplinarian dad. One, the economy is in better shape. Families are under less economic pressure. As Katie said, mothers are less likely to be forced to work in the 1950s and 60s, although that begins to increase, and they've got more time at home with kids. But certainly those ideas about the ways that parenting affects how children grow up psychologically is influencing parents. And so parents are concerned about spending time with their kids, about caring for them, showing affection, and all of that. But I suppose the other thing, and I think you're one of your people who sent in a text, Tony, talked about free-range kids. There's no doubt that in the 50s and 60s that Australians growing up in that period had a degree of independence to roam in ways that I think it's harder for Australian kids to do that today. I mean, the new suburbs or country towns or regional Australia, kids went to the beach, they went to the bush, they went to the park. Certainly I did in the early 60s. I can remember whole days away from home with a group of mates hanging out in the bush, up in the hills, on the beach and so on. That's a pretty significant part of childcare. And I guess there was a sense then that parents didn't have to be always involved with their kids, that actually kids got a lot out of being together with other kids and learning about life outside the home.
But Alistair, I think also that sense that the village was somehow involved still in raising the child might have still been there. I mean, I remember my dad telling me a story about he was off doing something with no parental supervision, but some friend of his father's saw him doing something he shouldn't have. And you know, that the friend went and knocked on the door, and when my dad got home, he was in trouble. Because, you know, in those days, I mean, and these are the stories that I've heard, if you were doing something wrong, whoever saw you went and dobbed on you, so you could be disciplined.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think probably in the sort of new suburbs out there, I mean, in a way, it probably would have been mothers rather than fathers, although the knocking on the door might be in the evening and dad might be there to be disciplinary. But actually, you know, in the new suburbs where there's a lot of mothers around, keeping an eye on kids collectively as well as separately.
Now, Katie, I want to come back to you because we have already touched on Dr. Spock, the Common Sense Book of Baby and Childcare. It was first published in 1946, and Alistair sort of gave us some sense of why it was so revolutionary, but how widespread was it? Because I'm also guessing, as we've now got television coming into people's lives and radio is there, that we're actually getting advice now from all this new media about parenting too.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And, you know, Spock is so significant because he reacts against the idea of the authoritarian parent where discipline is emphasised and predictability and training and, you know, hygiene and health, etc. And there's a particular context for that. But Spock's reacting against that He's also reacting to the idea that authoritarian structures, which have been exposed in, you know, World War II in particular, to be really wanting, are not necessarily what's desirable in our world. So he advocates a flexible, child-centered parenting approach that's rooted in ideas about affection and psychological well-being. It's a very down-to-earth and practical style, and he really famously encourages parents to trust yourself. You know more than you think you do. And his ideas are picked up really widely, and he's publishing versions or editions of his book that he changes right up into the 70s. And they're getting picked up, as you say, you know, in media, but also, I think, through things like the Women's Weekly, women's magazines are constantly publishing parenting advice columns. So there's all sorts of ways in which this advice is disseminated. So even if parents, particularly women, weren't reading these books themselves, they would have been picking it up through these other mediums, radio, television, you know, magazines, newspapers, were all avenues of spreading the advice. Some see Spock as really influencing a sort of much more permissive approach to parenting, but you could also see him as giving parents permission to not just be a bit more relaxed, but also to actually enjoy their children and enjoy being parents. I think those two different styles of the kind of authoritative Truby King and Spock are still evident in the strands of parenting that we see today.
So, Katie, if we just stay with you, what happened in the 70s and 80s? Because as we were saying, you know, women and mothers up until then were still seen as the primary caregivers. All that started really changing the 70s and 80s, didn't it?
Absolutely, it did. And, you know, one of the things that Spock gets criticised for is for, you know, understanding that the primary parent has to be the mother. And that's certainly the approach that he has. And even in his early 1970, I think 71 edition of his book, you know, he's very dark about, you know, the idea that women might be going out to work and that would lead to maternal deprivation and, you know, kids that have behavioural problems and all those sorts of things. So he's really takes a while to get on board with the idea that women might want to and even need to work. So women's liberation, you know, is really kind of an earthquake in the family and in many women's lives. And it challenges the idea that the mother had to be the primary parent. It challenges the structure of the family and the idea of the father as the breadwinner and the authoritative figure. So it's challenging the kind of the patriarchy of the family. And it also then leads to it takes a while, but it leads to women's entry into the paid workforce, and so particularly middle class women's. And so you have then the development of caregiving outside of the home and what we now know as the childcare industry. So that begins in the 70s and really then slowly develops into what, you know, it is today, which is, you know, a multi-million dollar industry. You also have a lot of research around parenting and ideas about parenting, a lot of work around development psychology and child psychology and child development that starts to influence ideas about parenting as well. So the 70s or 80s are really significant in terms of shifting family dynamics.
Yeah. This is Nightlife. You're on ABC Radio, Suzanne Hill with you on this Friday night. We're talking about the way that parenting's changed, really, I guess, since World War II. Alistair Thompson is with me, Emeritus Professor of History at Monash University and co-author of Fathering and Australian History. And Katie Holmes is here too, Professor of History and Director of La Trobe University's Centre for the Study of Inland. So, Alistair, then we get to the 90s, and this is where divorce rates really start to rise. These are the kind of Gen X kids. Sometimes they were called latchkey kids because sometimes these were the kids who were getting home to an empty house instead of a mother who was waiting there for them with freshly baked cookies.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot shifting. I mean, as Katie's talked about, the sort of cultural expectations that change influenced by second wave feminism in the 70s challenging men's and women's roles in the family. It's interesting, Katie talked about the increase of paid childcare when more and more mothers are out at work. But early feminism was also, for a time, arguing that actually dads should, as women go out to work, dads should come back into the home and spend more time. And there's a small increase in primary carer dads in the 70s and 80s, gets up to about 6% of Australian families, but then it plateaus and indeed drops off a bit because paid childcare fills the gap rather than fathers. But in terms of the structural change, you're right, divorce, after no-fault divorce from the mid-1970s, the divorce rates increase, the number of single parents increase. They tend to be single mothers with a significant proportion of absent dads and really significant campaigns about how do you force absent dads to pay maintenance? And from that, you get an increasingly angry fathers movement arguing against being forced to pay maintenance, arguing about the amount to which they have access to their children and so on. So you've got that significant structural change. You've also got the fact that by the 90s, increasingly, as Katie said earlier, most Australian families need two incomes. Most mums are now working. Men's employment's much less stable than it had been in the past. And so hence the need for paid childcare. And I guess the other thing that's beginning to happen by the 90s is that there are families that have no dads, either because it's a single mum or you've got lesbian couples having kids, and you get the beginning of families with two dads, with gay dads. So there's a really significant shift from the sort of archetypal, stereotypical nuclear family in the 1950s and 60s. By the 1990s, that's a minority, basically, and the range of different family formations in Australia are very diverse, shaped by a range of different factors and developments.
And Alistair, when would you say that the helicopter parenting generation begins?
Look, it's funny. I think I began to hear that notion when I was a young dad in the 1990s, but I think probably late 1990s, early 21st century. And I think that partly grows out of those cultural expectations that, from Spock onwards, that actually how parents care for their kids makes a big difference in shaping the psychological development of kids. I think it comes out of the fact that, as Katie said before, family size gets smaller. There's a bit of a bump increase in the 1950s and 60s during the baby boom, and then it drops again. There's a short increase during the Howard government with the baby bonus, but then it drops again. And so smaller families mean that you can parent more intensively. I think also that sort of ideas about safety and concerns about kids out on the streets, cars, streets don't feel so safe, whether that's real or just perceived. But also parental concerns about how well their kids are going to do in life and putting time into educating them, organising activities. So rather than that sort of free-range childhood that people possibly a bit nostalgically remember from the 50s and 60s, increasingly kids are being ferried around, ferried to school, ferried to activities, after-school activities and so on. Whether you call that helicopter parenting, but it's actually certainly more intensive parenting than in earlier generations of Australian families.
I want to have a chat with Barbara. Barbara, normally of Falconbridge, but tonight in Armidale. Hello, Barbara. Oh, I've got pressed the wrong button. There you are, Barbara.
To you before you went on your lovely holiday.
Yes, and now I know, because you're telling us you're one of the first baby boomers, and I know that you've told us your 80th birthday is coming up at the end of January, which I guess puts you spot in the demographic. So what do you remember of the way you grew up?
Well, I remember my parents having to work very hard, and because I was an only child, a lot fell on my shoulders to sort of help out. And it meant that I had to do shopping and help cook and wash up and just general household duties, and lonely because I was an only child. And I was determined I wouldn't have just one child, and I had two. And I was determined that I would always be there for them, and only worked in school hours and things like that. That's how I changed my parenting.
Right. And how did that go? I mean, are you?
I'm the worst mother ever. No, not really.
Sure, that's not true, Barbara. No,
sort of, but not. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I guess there are two people in the relationship, right? The parent and the child. So, from your perspective, you got what you wanted.
Well, I did what I thought was right.
Yeah.
And I think a little bit now they're appreciating it when they've had their own kids and all that sort of thing, but. you know, at one stage there, all I ever got was all the things I did wrong.
Oh.
None of the things I did right, you know, but yeah.
Yeah, wow. Was there anything, so the main thing about your childhood that you might have wished would be different, Barbara, was the fact that you were so lonely by the sounds of it.
And also that my mother worked and wasn't there enough.
Mm.
And that, I think it was to do with the post-war thing and, the, you know, it wasn't all that long after the Depression, there was the war. And I just think they were trying to make, well, they did. They, you know, they built up a little bit of, they bought a house, you know, which is unusual these days, isn't it? But, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And did you have one of those free-range childhoods, Barbara? Were you off doing whatever you wanted?
Oh, yeah. I could have disappeared as long as I was there at sunset, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what my dad said it was like for him too. Hey, thanks, Barbara. I'll speak to you in another month or so.
Yeah, have a lovely time.
All right, thanks, Barbara. I'll talk to you later. We're talking about the history of parenting. Have you got an experience from your own childhood about the way that perhaps how you were brought up influenced the way that you parented your own children? 1-300-800-222. It's ABC Radio, Suzanne Hill with you on Nightlife. Alistair Thompson is here with me. Alistair's Emeritus Professor of History at Monash University, co-author of Fathering and Australian History. And Katie Holmes is here too, Professor of History and Director of La Trobe University Centre for the Study of the Inland. So we just talked about helicopter parenting. Katie, gentle parenting is another name given to parenting that's perhaps more recent. What is gentle parenting and where did that come from?
So I have to say that before I was asked to, you know, join this discussion tonight, I'd only just started to hear about gentle parenting through some friends of mine who were kind of raising questions about the ways in which their grandchildren were being parented. And so I, you know, had to do a little bit of research around gentle parenting to discover what actually it's about. You know, is it just another trend? So as I understand it, gentle parenting has an emphasis on connection and emotional safety. So this the child-parent relationship is, you know, the central relationship. It's grounded in trust and empathy and a lot of emphasis on open communication, validating children's emotions. So you began this show by talking about, you know, the idea that, you know, is there something you that you want to express here? Can you tell me what it is you're feeling, rather than focusing on what the behaviour the child might be enacting is. So it's, you don't discipline through punishment. It's about teaching, modelling proper behaviour. There's no yelling, there's no shaming, there's no time out, no isolation, rather, you know, for discipline. There's, you know, a real emphasis on the child as an individual, a huge amount of negotiation of everything, and a focusing on kind of emotional regulation, helping children to identify and name and manage their feelings, with the assumption that children are going to learn that regulation by seeing it modelled in their parent and having their parent help them learn to regulate. And then the, I guess, the long-term development goals of it is it sort of prioritises long-term skills of empathy and resilience and communication over sort of short-term compliance. So that's the kind of broad understanding that I have of gentle, what we call gentle parenting.
So what kind of, what were you hearing about it when you started hearing about it from friends whose grandchildren were being brought up with gentle parenting?
I started hearing comments like, everything's a negotiation. You don't negotiate with a two-year-old about whether their dirty nappy needs changing. It just needs changing. You know, you don't have to have, that's not a point of negotiation. Comments like, you know, you can't negotiate with a two-year-old terrorist. And so this sort of sense of a concern about the exhaustion level of the parent parents who are having to parent in this way, because it is emotionally incredibly exhausting. It demands a huge amount of self-control on behalf of the parent and the capacity to be there and to be centered and to be, you know, endlessly understanding. There's also a real concern about it lacking boundaries, that children actually don't know what's expected of them, and that children, you know, in sort of from the point of view of my friends, would They would argue that children need some sort of structure. They need to understand the boundaries. They need to understand what is acceptable and non-acceptable behaviour, that you can't negotiate over everything. And that, you know, it is not necessarily having the desired effects that one might hope to see, for example, in the school ground and in the school classroom.
Alistair, have you also noticed gentle parenting? Can you point to the its emergence in a historical timeline at all?
Look, I think a bit like Katie, I can point to it just from experience of friends and family. I mean, I think Katie and I were both young parents around the same time in the early 90s, and those notions of boundaries and stability, you know, unconditional love, but also clear boundaries and stability were really important in our generation. If I look at my daughter parenting now, and she's probably listening to this now, but I think those ideas of gentle parenting and emotional negotiation and so on are more prevalent amongst her, a younger generation of parents. And, you know, you can see how that just gets really hard when a two-year-old or a four-year-old puts their foot down and screams and shouts and whatever. And, you know, I think working out how to deal with that, you know, is hard, whether you were a parent 50 years ago or right now. How we deal with it, though, I think, as Katie was suggesting, has changed across time. And if we just look at ourselves as parents, our kids as parents, and our parents as parents, you can see the different approaches to how we deal with, kids who are giving us a hard time about stuff.
I mean, I remember when I was a kid, it would be enough. I'd say, but why? Because I said so. That was enough of an answer. I don't think that's acceptable anymore if you say that to a child. Alistair, though, do you think there are any core beliefs or values that have remained the same throughout the history of parenting?
That's such a good question. I've been thinking about that. I think, I reckon change and diversity about parenting are probably more significant than continuity or universality. In other words, I don't think people have always done it the same, and I think there's probably been more change than continuity. If I was thinking for things that are reasonably, if not consistent, I think we've, across history, there's been a recognition that how you parent affects kids, but precisely how you do it and who does it, that's certainly changed across time. I reckon it's also, it's pretty hard to shift the belief that mums have a primary and more significant role than dads in the early years of childcare. You know, and even though I think there's an increasing recognition that dads can do it too, and dads can do it equally well, and that actually mums don't always want to do it in those early years, there are still really powerful understandings in the workplace, for example, if a dad wants to take time off and go and be flexible. I think it gets frowned upon more. And you can see it in different models of paid parental leave as well. So I think shifting that, I mean, if we learnt one thing from the history of fathering that I co-authored with colleagues, it's that if you really want fathers to play a continuing and significant role in caring for their kids and raising them and not just providing for them, then they need to be primary carers in the first couple of years. And you need paid parental leave systems and wage systems and flexible work systems that allow that to happen. Because if you don't do it in the first couple of years, you get left behind and you become secondary parents as dads, and mums tend up taking the greater load. And I think both mums and dads and kids all suffer from that.
Yeah. And now on the SMS, Katie, maybe I'll throw this one at you. It just says, I'm interested to know your guest thoughts on the trend for adult children to cancel their parents and the resulting estrangement. I know so many people that this has happened to. And I was reflecting too that I suspect that over the years, children have become perhaps more literate about what they expect from their parents, and children are talking quite a lot about, you know, what makes a good parent and what makes a bad parent. And perhaps the expectations from children themselves are higher when it comes to their parents. Katie, do you have any reflections on that one?
I think that's a really interesting observation and sort of trend. And I think that we can perhaps trace that back to the kind of increasing dissemination around what makes a good parent. And if you have a lot of ideas about what makes a good parent, then you're and they differ from the ways in which you were parented, then you are inclined to look back on the way in which you were parented and perhaps be rather critical of the ways in which your mother or your father reared you. I guess I would think that we also are often very quick to, we are increasingly quick to judge and to think that the contemporary understanding is the right one, and often perhaps don't have enough appreciation of the kinds of conditions and expectations that were on the generation ahead of us, prior to us. So I would also say that there's, I think, picking up the comment about what are some of the strands that haven't changed. I think we can see a real strand from Spock and Bowlby through the kind of development of the responsiveness, the responsive parent, the parent who values the emotional needs of the child, through to the kind of positive parenting into the gentle parenting as well. There's that strand of that gets stronger and stronger about positive reinforcement and an increasing lessening of the boundaries. And I think if parents today are rejecting, for example, that as a model of parenting and wanting there to have been more boundaries, then they might be likely to be critical of their mother or their father, probably particularly the mother, who has always been the main target for the good or bad parent, really, in the sense of carrying, as Al says, that primary responsibility for the caregiving, particularly in those early years. So it is generally the mother who cops so much of the blame for whether she did a good job or not. Because that mother-daughter relationship can be so intense, I think that magnifies that experience.
Now, Katie, you did just pick up on another aspect of parenting, which we didn't really go into, positive parenting, which I think perhaps in the noughties was one of the big movements. It's the kind of thing that I know some social researchers have pushed back at and saying, if we tell every child that they are special and that they can do everything, and, you know, we go up to the school and we say, no, my child's a genius, they can't possibly have done this or not be getting straight A's, that you actually set them up for failure. Is positive parenting still strong, or is that one that people have looked back on and gone, maybe that's not the best, or do you think it's still very much in play?
Well, I think we can certainly see the influences of positive parenting in gentle parenting. I think it's still very much there. You know, positive parenting was the kind of in vogue in the late 20th, early 21st century. So that was around the time when I was parenting. And I remember, you know, driving to work, listening to Life Matters and having, you know, I can't remember the name of the 3 P's positive parenting guy that was on, you know, once a week telling us all how, you know, giving suggestions as how we might parent our children. Very strong in that period. And I think that trend of that, there's certainly elements of that still exist in that kind of gentle parenting mode. But as with the gentle parenting and as with critique of that, so with positive parenting, that actually it's not realistic. You know, in the real world, you know, there are rules, you get told off, there's things that go wrong, you know, you can't get affirmed for every single thing you do, particularly if you're not doing the right thing. And so there's a sort of bit of a pushback on that.
And Alistair,
where they get around and, you know, find out sort of is coming from as well.
Yeah. And Alistair too, I mean, I think there are a lot of teachers in classrooms who were saying all this gentle parenting, it's not helping us actually discipline in classrooms. Have you been hearing that from people you've spoken to?
Oh, look, a little bit. I guess I'm just thinking, as you're talking about positive parenting, I'm thinking about, well, what would be the opposite of that, negative parenting? And I guess one of the really striking developments across the last century is ideas about corporal punishment. And, you know, if you listen to people talking about being raised in the 1920s and 30s in Australia, there's a lot of violence and a blurred line between corporal punishment and domestic violence. And increasingly, there's a shift away from corporal punishment. Domestic violence carries on and continues to be significant and prevalent across all sorts of Australian families. But corporal punishment as an accepted thing to do within families basically becomes less and less acceptable, in the same way that corporal punishment in schools also becomes less and less acceptable. And, you know, to my mind, that's a good thing. I mean, I don't think violence is a particularly effective way of parenting. And there are other ways of, you know, trying to maintain boundaries, trying to encourage good behaviour and so on. So, you know, if positive parenting is not negative parenting and it doesn't involve pretty violent corporal punishment, that seems to me to be an improvement.
And yet, Alistair, I bet there are lots of our listeners who will say, oh, I got the smack, I got the strap when I was a kid and I turned out fine. I don't know. And Alistair, Katie, thank you so much. It's been really interesting just to try and take stock of how parenting in Australia has changed over the last, I guess, 80 to 100 years. Thank you so much for being my guest tonight. Alistair Thompson. Alistair's Emeritus Professor of History at Monash University and co-author of Fathering, an Australian History. Thanks, Alistair.
Thanks so much, Suzanne.
And also big thanks to Katie Holmes. Katie is a professor of history at La Trobe University. Katie, thank you so much for being here tonight.
Many thanks, Suzanne. Really enjoyed the conversation.
That is Katie Holmes.